Well, good evening and welcome to the final presentation in this, our 18th season of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster, Haiwang Wan, and our facility specialist, Daniel Peach. Katie Reeder designed our poster, and our technical specialist tonight is Shadden Melky. Our speaker tonight was born in the United States to Iranian parents, but moved to Iran when he was 10 and lived there until his 20s. He experienced a revolution, interstate war, and being a foreign student upon returning to the United States as an undergraduate in Texas. He received his PhD from the University of California, Riverside in 1998 for a dissertation on regime transition in post-Soviet Central Asia, the cases of Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, which involved extensive fieldwork in Central Asia in 1994 and 1996. He's taught at the University of California, Riverside, California State University, Dominguez Hills, and South Texas College, where he met his wife, who taught French. He joined the faculty at WKU in 2002 and is an associate professor of comparative politics in the Department of Political Science, where he teaches classes on Middle East politics, international relations, comparative politics, and political terrorism. His research focuses on regime transitions, Middle East politics, and public diplomacy, and he's frequently asked to comment about Middle Eastern affairs for various media. He's led study abroad programs to Turkey, Belgium, and the Netherlands, where he taught courses on Islam and citizenship in Europe, Middle East politics, and Islam and politics. His interest in Morocco began in Brussels, Belgium, where over a quarter of the population are from Turkey and Morocco. He taught a course there on identity politics of old and new immigrants. And in the spring of 2013, a Moroccan Fulbright professor teaching Arabic at Western enrolled in his U.S. foreign policy class. With his help, he took his first group of students to Morocco in 2015. Last summer, he led his third study abroad program in Morocco, where WKU students interacted with local public officials and upon their return, wrote about their experience in an article entitled Local Governance in Morocco During Political Instability, with a focus on Tetouan, a city of some 400,000 people near Tangier on the Mediterranean coast. He'll be making a return trip to Morocco this June and July, and here to talk about Morocco at the crossroads of Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, please welcome Saul Yastapour.
Thank you, Dr. Coots, and thank you to the library staff for putting this together. And I see some of my students who went on the program here, and hopefully you can ask them questions afterwards and not just me. Anyway, I'm really happy to be here. I also see a lot of people in the community that I see either at Cariacas or other places running and enjoying life in Bowling Green, so that's really nice. And I put together a very long presentation, so I'm going to have to decide on the fly here what to include and what to exclude. But I first wanted to start off by talking about why Morocco. Morocco is a really diverse state, and I think it's a great place for American students to learn about the diversity of the Middle East and North Africa. Often we're presented images of a very homogenous region in terms of the Middle East, you know, very essentialized, Arabized groups that typically live all across the region and represent multiple ethnic groups are hardly represented. And so I like my students to be able to experience this. Dr. Coots mentioned that I traveled to Turkey in the past. Turkey is another good example where students can see that diversity. And so with that said, Morocco also combines the old and new. So it's both modern and also very historic. And it has a lot of diversity geographically and topographically as well. So Morocco is situated in North Africa. It's the westernmost country in North Africa, an area that's called the Maghreb. What I do in my classes on Middle East, especially, is to talk about where the terminology comes from, because there are a lot of nomenclature in terms of identifying the region. So the Middle East itself is a loaded term. It was coined, some argue, by an American Admiral Alfred Thayer Mann, who is a big proponent of sea power, and he called it the Middle East, this region. The British also used this term, and so it became very popular. In fact, so popular that people who live in that region call it the Middle East as well. So in Arabic, Asharq al-Awsat means the Middle East. In Farsi, Khadar al-Mi'aneh, same terminology, even though if you're living in the Middle East, you're not in the middle of anyone's east. You're where you live. It's a loaded term, and probably the best thing to call this area is North Africa and Southwest Asia. Another big topic is, you know, why should we include the Morocco in a definition of the Middle East, which I'll talk about in a minute here. But there's a neat site called MapFight, and you can see the two maps there fighting, California versus Morocco. They're very similar in size. In fact, Morocco is a little bit larger. I haven't included the disputed region to the south of Morocco, known as the Western Sahara, because it's disputed. My Moroccan friends would dispute that with me and would want me to include it, so hopefully no one's going to send this to them. There you can see Morocco transposed over Kentucky, Indiana, and Tennessee to get a better sense of the size. Population-wise, it's smaller in population compared to California, but more than Texas. It's about 34 million people, very similar to Canada. But this is a good map to show you kind of the area that I include in my definition of the Middle East and North Africa. Sometimes it's referred to as MENA. So starting over here with Morocco, and going eastward across North Africa, Egypt is often included in everyone's definition of the Middle East because part of Egypt is actually in Asia. But of course, these are situated in Africa. The term Middle East is even disputed within the U.S. federal government. So the State Department has a Near Eastern Affairs Bureau, which refers, it's synonymous to the Middle East. They include Morocco in that grouping, whereas the Department of Defense includes Morocco and Africa. So the term AFRICOM, or African Command, includes the country of Morocco. So that's very interesting in terms of the use of the lexicon. One of the reasons I mentioned that Morocco is a very interesting place to visit is because of the diversity of its ethno-linguistic groups. Here you see a WKU student who's actually here with us, with a gentleman who's a representative of, or could be classified as a Tuareg. There's a Tuareg guide who took us to see Ait Ben Haddou with a WKU student. The WKU student, his face is not visible. The other person is the Tuareg. Anyway, I'm sure you knew that, but here are a group of high school students who consider themselves to be Amazigh. Amazigh is the proper term to refer to this ethno-linguistic group. The Western term that's very common is Berber, and a lot of Amazigh believe that that's a pejorative term. So at times I may interchange and use Berber to refer to certain things, but Amazigh is the more appropriate term. Students here are wearing, high school students are wearing the national costume of Amazigh and some wedding attire as well. We visit a lot of museums on the trip and really get to learn about both the Arab culture and Amazigh culture, as well as the Sahrawi and Tuareg cultures when we visit Morocco. And here we're at a museum, an Amazigh museum, and checking out the artifacts. We were able to go and try on a lot of Berber attire or Amazigh attire, and it's a very proud culture. They have led a movement to be recognized as a official language, and the most recent amendments, reforms to their constitution in 2011 have resulted in Tamazight being the second official language after Arabic in Morocco. I'm not 100% sure if most of these students are Arab. I know one student is from WKU, who's in this picture, but she's from Egypt and not from Morocco. But the rest of them are students from Fez, who they were probably the most Arabized of the people that we had contact with. Berbers and Arabs have intermingled over the years, and so if you look in the CIA World Factbook on ethnic groups in Morocco, it'll say 99% Arab Berber. So they basically just fuse the two and say that's what they are. But if you talk to an Amazigh, they will tell you, "I'm Amazigh." And so there are a lot of distinctions that are lost in representations of identity in the Middle East. And that's a good example of that. Also, there's a lot of religious diversity in Morocco. Granted, it is about 90% Muslim, but it has been influenced by both the Jewish tradition and the Christian tradition. In the city of El Jadida, which used to be called Magazen, you can see three houses of worship in this picture that we took from the ramparts. There's a mosque, a Christian church, and a synagogue. And some close-up shots here. There's the mosque, the synagogue, and the inside of that church. So you get to see a lot of this in Morocco, not just mosques, but also Catholic churches, especially in the north. And here in this former Portuguese city, there are synagogues and churches. Morocco boasts 9 UNESCO World Heritage Sites, which is ties it with Ethiopia in Africa as having the most. And we on the program get to visit 7 and sometimes 8 of these sites. So they're very historic, wonderful places for the students to visit to be able to see all the different influences, including Roman influences, as well as Portuguese, Spanish, and French. I probably am not going to go over this slide. As I said, I'm going to cut some things out here, but this is a brief history going back as far as the conquest of northern Africa by the Phoenicians. And so something that I wanted to mention here is that Arab and Amazigh rulers have ruled Morocco since for a very long time. The Amazigh, in fact, were established governments, and so unlike a lot of Arab countries, they have a pre-Islamic period where they actually have dynasties that ruled the region and were fairly advanced in terms of state and nation building. Here are ruins in Volubilis near Moulay Idris or Meknes, close by, and you can see the Roman influences there in Volubilis. One aspect of Morocco that also lends itself well to teaching about the Middle East and North Africa is the fact that many Middle Eastern and North African countries have been colonized. Morocco is no exception, but it's really interesting in that, as I just mentioned, they're fairly unique in that they had independent self-governance prior to colonialism. And also, they were not a full colony. They were seen as being a protectorate split between France and Spain for a very long period of time. They also had the Portuguese influence along the coast. I'm going to show you a couple of maps here that will demonstrate the this. This is the some images from Essaouira, where students got to visit these fortifications along the coast, and these are built by the Portuguese. On the far right is a picture of the cistern in El Jadida, which is another city along the Atlantic coast that was dominated by the Portuguese in the 1500s. In addition to Portuguese influence, of course, Morocco is heavily influenced by the French. Here are images of French architecture in various cities, particularly Rabat and Casablanca. Down here, this is the post and telegraph building in Rabat, which is a quintessential colonial French architecture. In the north, the Spanish controlled the northern part of Morocco, and we can see in the city of Tetuan a Catholic church as well as a Spanish colonial architecture. The Morocco is a good case study, again, to demonstrate how colonial powers divided up the Middle East and North Africa. In these two images or pictographs, you see the great power rivalry of the day. The British and the French reached an agreement known as an Entente Cordiale, and the Germans at the time, Prussians probably more correctly, were trying to kind of disrupt those plans. But if you look at Morocco's history, you can see how colonial powers over time divided up the region, including Morocco itself. So in 1900, for example, France and Italy signed a secret agreement that assigned Morocco to France and Libya to Italy. In 1902, a similar arrangement occurred between France and Spain, where they divided up Moroccan territory between the two of them. In 1904, France and Britain made a pact called the Entente Cordiale, and they agreed, France agreed, that they would not build any fortifications next to the area known as Gibraltar, in exchange for Britain allowing France to colonize, take over, and influence Morocco. All of this is happening, by the way, when there's actually a Moroccan sultan who's ruling Morocco. So this kind of shows how the process of colonization in Morocco was a little bit different. It wasn't like Algeria, where you had direct French colonization. It wasn't similar to India with the British. But it's a good way of looking at how colonization and decolonization impacts states in the region. In 1905, Kaiser Wilhelm II visited Tangier, which was an international city, and he basically said, I recognize Morocco as an independent state. Now, he was doing this because he wanted to basically disrupt France and Britain's land grab during the scramble for Africa. As a result, many of the great powers decided to get together in Algeciras, Spain, to convene the Algeciras Conference and essentially guarantee France control over Morocco. So Germany lost out here. I think the only country that sided with Morocco Germany was Austria-Hungary, but the powers of the day, including the United States, agreed that France should continue to control Morocco. So you see in this map here the colonial influences. In the north, there is a Spanish protectorate. There is an international city of Tangier. Before the Reef Republic was created, this was under the control of the Spanish, and southern Morocco was also controlled by Spain. The rest of Morocco was under the control of France. So as I said, the Moroccan sultans were still in power during this entire period, and in 1956, Mohammed V, on the far right there, was able to renegotiate with France the restoration of independence. In 1956, they were able to regain the city of Tangier from the Spanish, and the Spanish relinquished control over a lot of the areas in the north and the Spanish Sahara, which then was called the Western Sahara. After the death of Mohammed V, his son on the far left, King Hassan II, ruled for 38 years, I believe, in Morocco. And he was an authoritarian leader. This period is known as the Years of Lead because of the harsh repression by the regime. Yet Hassan II also used his authority to increase some civil rights in Morocco. He was succeeded by his son Mohammed VI, who is the current king of Morocco. So from a political science perspective, Morocco is also a good case to look at in terms of identifying what the sources of legitimacy and authority are in a typical state in the Middle East and North Africa. Many of the monarchies are able to rule because of traditional legitimacy. The Moroccan sultans are no different. They're able to trace their lineage to Ali ibn Abi Talib, and they're known as the Alawite clan. And as a result, they're able to claim greater legitimacy through other symbols. The King of Morocco is also known as the Amir al-Mu'minin, which is the commander of the faithful. As such, Moroccan kings have been able to use charismatic authority as well. A lot of religious symbols are used throughout their reign, and this has helped Morocco to avoid falling into the so-called Islamist trap, where Islamist parties, religious parties dominate certain countries, whereas in Morocco, the sultan has been able to use his lineage, use those symbols of religiosity to maintain a Islamic authority as well. For example, Mohammed Adoui argues that in order to analyze how Morocco, the Moroccan monarchy has been able to retain power over time, he says you have to look at the sociocultural aspects, not just institutional aspects of rule, which include these symbolisms, the religious allegiance that Moroccans give to their ruler that's known as the Beya is one example of that. Mohammed the Sixth has initiated some reforms, and Morocco is looking a little bit more like a constitutional monarchy, but it is still very much a state that's ruled by the king. Here's some images of the annual Bay'a, and also the king bestowing gifts. This is on the bottom right, you see the king giving a Quran to an African on one of Muhammad VI's many visits to sub-Saharan Africa. So the Moroccan monarch uses his religious authority to maintain power and authority, and many people respect that as well. A couple things about Morocco in terms of the Arab Spring. Morocco was very quick to initiate reforms when the Arab Spring happened. It actually engaged in reforms prior to the Arab Spring, so in a way they were able to keep ahead of the protests. The February 20th movement in 2011 was influenced by the Arab Spring. A lot of young people, as we saw in Egypt, using social media, gathered in the squares to demand an end to corruption. They called for social and economic equality, and they also wanted the king to reign but not rule. Overall, since the Arab Spring, the level of political participation hasn't increased significantly in terms of voter turnout. Those traditional modes of citizen participation. However, a lot of associations have been created, and those were the result of the February 20th movement. Here's an image of that of the protests. These protests, by the way, were much smaller and not as intense as the ones, say, in Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and so forth. The Moroccans were able to react to the Arab Spring in a way to withstand the protests and also solidify the rule of the monarch. So they benefited by basically separating the opposition. They were very quick to initiate reforms. A lot of the political parties did not participate in the actual movement, so there were just a lot of young people out in the street. And over time, you know, they got fatigued, and the monarch initiated some constitutional changes, including increasing greater freedoms for women. They made changes to the Mudawwana, which is the family code, basically banning polygamy, and increasing the age of marriage to 18, and other changes that were beneficial for women in particular. Also, they agreed to allow Tamazight to be the second official language. In Morocco, there weren't very many calls for revolution, as there were, say, in Egypt, in Libya, and we can see a big difference in terms of how things have fared since the Arab Spring. If you look at Tunisia, they had a regime change. If you look at Libya, Yemen, Egypt, well, not so much Egypt, but Yemen, Syria, and Libya are all in a civil war right now in all those countries. Bahrain also had a lot of violence that ultimately was quelled by the intervention of Saudi Arabia. Yet Morocco was able to kind of withstand the Arab Spring, and the monarchy actually came out looking better afterwards. Much of the reforms, some argue, are cosmetic. They're definitely more top-down than bottom-up, as may have happened in places like Egypt. Some aspects of Morocco's foreign policy involve territorial issues that it has with its neighbors. because of Spanish colonialism, there are certain territories in Morocco that are still controlled by Spain, and Morocco is not very happy about that. Ceuta, Melilla, and a very small island that the Spanish called Peril and the Moroccans called Leila Island, which is, I think, 250 meters off the coast of Morocco, but Spain still controls it. And Ceuta, even maybe more, glaringly, is actually, and Melilla are on Moroccan soil. Western Sahara, which is in the south, the Spanish Sahara used to be called that, is disputed. There's a group known as the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic that's backed by Algeria. They claim that this Western Sahara belongs to them, whereas Morocco has retained control of it. There are disputes over the Algeria border as well, between Morocco and Algeria. We visit Ceuta, which is in Spain, technically, and there's a statue of the great Arab cartographer Muhammad al-Idrisi, who created a map of the world that was used for over 300 years. It was so well done that it continued to be used, and it's still used today to visualize the area of the modern, or the world as it was known in the 1100s when he drew it. But here's a good shot of how close Morocco is to Spain. We visit this area with students and get to see Ceuta, as I mentioned, and you can see Gibraltar from there as well. And that's only 8.7 miles that separate the two. Of course, this is very much in the news because of all the migration that's going on from sub-Saharan Africa. In 2015, close to 3,000 people died trying to cross the sea routes. It's very interesting. There's a lot of migration within Africa that we don't hear about. So people are moving as refugees to other African states, but the only news that we get are those that are going to Europe. But it's putting a lot of strain on a lot of countries in Africa itself, including Morocco. If you notice over here, a lot of people in Africa that are trying to leave try to go by getting to the Canary Islands, which is owned by Spain. And so that's on the over here. And also one route is going through Ceuta to Spain and Melilla. And most of them are going through Libya towards Italy. But it's a very dangerous trek, but continues to be a problem for not only Europe, also countries in Africa that have to deal with the influx of refugees and migrants. Here are a couple images of us crossing into Ceuta on one of the visits and entering Spain. That is not a WKU student going over the wall, but that's a Moroccan who, he's actually not landing in Spain on that picture, but rather he's trying to cut in line by getting closer to where he can get into Ceuta. I think he probably was arrested. I would have been arrested if they had seen me take that picture, too. I won't do that again. It was bad. It was bad. Here are three projections of Morocco, which I was told, I had a flyer that in my flyer, Morocco looked like this. And my colleague in Morocco told me, "Oh, I saw some of the stuff that you had, and don't bring that map that you have." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Oh, that map." And I couldn't figure out what map he was talking about. And I looked at my flyer, and I said, "Oh, it's a map of Morocco." And he said, "But it doesn't include the Western Sahara." So over here you have maps that show the Western Sahara is disputed, and this is the map that he wanted me to have, which would include the Western Sahara as part of Morocco.
It's a still a source of contention. In fact, Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, visited the UN mission in Western Sahara and referred to the Western Sahara as being occupied. Morocco got very angry and expelled many of the UN peacekeepers that are there to separate the Polisario rebels from the Moroccan military. To the left is a picture of the Green March, where over 350,000 Moroccans, on the order of the King of Morocco, King Hassan II, marched from Morocco into the Western Sahara along with 20,000 troops to claim Western Sahara as Moroccan territory. Let's see how we're doing on time here. A couple issues that Morocco continues to deal with, of course, the war on terror. We get to visit the American legation, and we were lucky enough to hear about Morocco's sacred security strategy to combat terrorism. So what is Morocco doing? Well, essentially what they're trying to do is they're trying to intervene early to prevent radicalization among the youth. And their solution is interesting, and it's backed with research that shows that it seems to be working. And that is, the Moroccan government is training women to become imams or murshidat, if you pronounce it the way the Moroccans do. So women can now teach their children about Islam. And the idea is that women are nicer than men. They're going to teach the children to love each other. Women are better organizers. There's evidence, one of the people that have researched this said that in his interviews, he said, well, so what's the point of having women do this, and why can't men do the organizing? And they said, well, when women try to organize a meeting at the mosque, 450 people might show up. When the men do it, 25 people show up. So they're really good at organizing. They're, and because they're of the role that the woman has within the family, the idea is that early on, you can prevent the youth from becoming radicalized by buying into radical views from other places that are basically changing what Islam is really about. Also, Morocco, they follow the Maliki school of Islam, which is a little bit different than the other madhhabs. For example, they accept the one of the legal sources of consensus. So if the community agree to something, this is known as ijma, the Moroccan ulama, the Muslim clergy, will accept that as law. So if the community wants something per se, then it can happen, and that might be seen as a little bit more progressive than maybe some of the other schools of Islam. There's a lot of debate over that. I'm not going to talk too much about some of these other issues, but Morocco has been in and out of the African Union for its stance on the Western Sahara. After 33 years, it just got back into it. Morocco has tried to intervene to mediate the dispute between Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates on the one hand, and Qatar on the other, and suggested that they could mediate between the parties. Saudi Arabia wasn't too happy about it, and they started broadcasting programming that referred to Morocco as annexing the Western Sahara, so Morocco got mad. And so there's a little bit of tension going on regarding Qatar. Morocco does have that very close proximity to Spain, and so it's a natural gateway for the European Union to send its goods across the border. And I'm going to show you some of that towards the end here. Of course, Islam is the majority religion in Morocco, and you can see a lot of influences of Islam in terms of the architecture and the art. This is the gateway, or the entryway, the door to the Quranic school in Fez. Here is an image inside the Qarawiyyin Mosque, which is not open to non-Muslims. I was able to go in with my colleague, and I don't know if this is the one that you can turn on here, but it's very beautiful on the inside as well as on the outside. If you pay the gentleman that sit at the door, they're okay with you filming. The mosques in Morocco are influenced by the different cultures in that region, including North African architecture, as we see here in a mosque in Tiznit. This is different than the typical mosques you see that are pictured from Morocco, in Casablanca, or the Hassan II Mosque. So that's very interesting as well. I talked about the geographic location of Morocco as another reason to travel there. Here are students right where the Strait of Gibraltar is, and you can see where the Mediterranean and the Atlantic meet because of the different currents. Water of the Mediterranean goes underneath the water of the Atlantic, and something's happening there that I can't explain because that's not my area, but it creates this movement, these underwater waves that you can actually see, and there's that line right there, I think I got it right, right across there. It looks really great from a satellite image as well, but that is the Strait of Gibraltar. I was talking about Layla Island. Layla Island is somewhere over here. I don't think I see it here, but it's almost right here, Ceuta, right there, and that's Spain. And that's Spain, even though all of this is Morocco. Again, Morocco is blessed with being along the Mediterranean and also the Atlantic. So it's a great place to go and surf. In fact, it has some excellent surfing. One of our students here was a natural, and he can tell you about his experience surfing for the very first time. I think it's because he has blonde hair. He can surf. And here's this is not Isaac, but it's someone from the last trip. I don't know if you can turn that one on. There's no sound on these, but they're having a lot of fun. It's the sound of the ocean. I mentioned mountains. Here's the Tizinchica Pass, which is the elevation 7,415 feet. That's a bus right there. So it's pretty impressive. Also a little bit stressful driving it. Here is a fabulous gorge. We did a hike here with students, and it's a very nice place, very different than other parts of Morocco, a lot of the mountains and gorges in Morocco. In the north, the Barbary apes can be sometimes seen. We were able to see them last time on the trip. The cypress forests in the north are amazing. Many people, of course, love the Sahara when they visit Morocco, and I think we had a wonderful experience every time we've been there. It's quite beautiful and breathtaking. I think I might want to just open up to questions, but I do want to emphasize that Morocco is a non-oil economy, so it's also interesting to study it, to learn how do a lot of the Middle Eastern countries that don't have oil deal with economic development. Morocco has the world's largest reserves of phosphate, and that's about 75% of the world's phosphate. They also make argon oil and argon products. I brought some of this stuff here to share with you, so when we're done, you can come up here and look at them. More recently, they've been developing their solar energy and exporting the electricity that is produced from the sun to African neighbors to the south. So that's a potential niche area for Morocco to take advantage of. Here are images of cars that are being imported or exported. I think these are going to France. These were vehicles that were assembled in Morocco. And over there is a picture of the Tangier Med Port facility where all this is happening. Everyone wants to hear about food. Food in Morocco is amazing. You can ask the students here who've been there when we open up to Q&A. But they make one of their main vessels for cooking is called the tagine, which I brought one here. This is not a Moroccan one. This is from France. And it is based on the same concept, but it's made out of fired ceramic. So this one won't crack or break as easily. It'll break if you throw it and slam it down, but it won't break when you're cooking with it. You have to be very careful with these traditional clay ones. I tried to bring back one and it broke on the way. I think, Maria, you were successful in bringing yours. No? It broke too. Yeah, you have to wrap them well. But it was $2. So I'll get another one when I go. Morocco is very influenced by a cafe culture. So they love coffee, they love tea, especially mint tea. And I brought a sample of that as well. A couple more pictures of spices and the foods of Morocco, which include tagines that are made in tagine, couscous, especially on Fridays. And the spices that they use, you can go into a shop there and ask for the allspice mix of the shop, and that's called the Ras el Hanout, which basically means the head of the shopkeeper, which basically is his secret combination, and this is from a spice shop in Morocco that I went to, and you can open this up and smell the spice, but that's pretty much what they use in almost all their cooking, especially if they're making a tagine. But perhaps the best reason to visit Morocco are its people. I think we've met a lot of wonderful students and made a lot of friends. Many of our students continue to keep in touch with them. We don't have sound here, unfortunately, but if you can play this one too. Emma, who's here tonight, she's interacting with some, I think they were middle school or high school students who were doing a...
We have sound. It's just very low.
Oh, it's okay. Basically, these students were participating in a program that was funded by the U.S. State Department, helping Moroccan students with their English, but in this particular class, they were working on creating a political advertisement. So different groups of students took on different issues like violence against women, terrorism, other concerns, and they created like posters, and then they talked about them in English, and they did a really good job, and our students helped them with their projects. All right. Yeah. Questions? Be honest. Yes, back here.
Yeah, so you touched on anti-terrorism techniques or counter-terrorism techniques with working with women and having them kind of teach their children how to view Islam, I guess. But I've also read kind of the alternative of that, that women are also radicalized and therefore teach their children to be radicalized as well. And is that being kind of a little gender imperative? So how do you see Morocco recognize that as well? And
I think it's a great question. I don't know if you heard her question, but she's asking about whether if you're
allowing the women to teach about Islam, could the women themselves become radicalized and maybe make the problem even worse? What's interesting about Morocco is that there are Moroccans that are involved in terrorism, but many of them are Moroccans who have left Morocco. A lot of them are Moroccans who live in France or in Belgium. Many of them have gone and joined ISIS. So you'll hear about terrorist events and acts, and the perpetrators are sometimes young Moroccan men, but they're not Moroccans that have been living in Morocco. To answer your question, I think there's definitely a cause for, men and women can both be radicalized. There's no question about that. And there are women, especially foreign fighting women, who go from Europe to Syria and become even more radicalized. And there could be Moroccans among them as well. But I think internally, because of the way that Islam is practiced and institutionalized within the state, this is all done through the Ministry of Religious Affairs. So any Moroccan woman can't go out and do this without being certified. They get training, and they get funded to do this. So unless they themselves are self-radicalized, it would be fairly unlikely that they're going to be teaching radical thoughts to the children. Does that answer your question? Any other questions?
Yes.
Yes, Al Hussein.
Yes, it's something about there was high cancer rates because of this.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Sure, sure.
Just repeat that for a bit.
Sure. The question is in regards to regional differences. Some areas that might be more pro-monarchy, and some that might be a little bit more like I think she used the term, the Wild West. But as I mentioned, a lot of the ethno-linguistic groups, it's a diverse country, and so you have some, like in the Reef, which is where that city is, where that you're referring to, where there's been some protests. In Al Hoceima, it involved fishermen who had was selling this fish, this type of fish that was at the time, they weren't supposed to be selling that fish, and the police came and they took his catch or his fish and threw him in the garbage truck, and he went into the garbage truck to retrieve the fish, and apparently the police turned on the trash compactor while he was in there, and this led to this fisherman's death and a lot of demonstrations in that region. And these are areas where maybe the king doesn't visit as often. The gross domestic product per capita doesn't reach there the same way it does the larger cities and more maybe some of the areas that are somewhat more Arabized. But there are definitely regional divisions. As you get closer to the Western Sahara, the Sahrawi, the Tuareg, they claim that they are treated as second-class citizens. But Tetuan, where you were, they're actually very rich. It's a very rich area, but they think of themselves as being close to Europe, and so they're looking for more social and economic and liberal reforms that the monarchy has not kept up with their demands. And so, and also a lot of them are Amazigh, and so they're proud of their Berber background as well. So that all ties in together. But you're absolutely right, there's that regional rivalry, for sure. Well,
Lex's drawing, obviously Morocco is an enormous tourist mecca. I went to Marrakesh, I was just struck by how many million people visit Marrakesh. What's the attraction
of Marrakesh?
Yes.
Well, I had a slide talking about Islamic medieval cities. So Marrakesh, Fez are great examples of Islamic cities. Typically an Islamic city, the main edifice is the Grand Mosque or the Jama Mosque, and around that is the souk or the market, the bazaar, as it might be called in some places, but in Morocco they call it the souk. So the market surrounds that Grand Mosque, and then beyond that you get the citadel or the kasba, sometimes called the kasaba, which is where the governor lives and his entourage. And there's a little mosque in that area, but this is closer to the wall, because all of Moroccan medieval cities were surrounded by walls. And so they refer to the Medina, the old Medina and the new Medina. The old Medina is what's behind those walls. And that's what that Islamic medieval city looks like, kind of like this concentric, levels of city planning. Then you get this where people live in the residential quarters, and then there's the network of streets, and then there's the wall that surrounds the city. And these are fortified to keep out invaders and so forth. And then beyond the wall is where you have the cemeteries. And so typically you'll have a Jewish cemetery and a Muslim cemetery, maybe even a Christian cemetery around these various cities. And Marrakesh is no exception. Marrakesh has boasts, I think 8 magnificent doors to the city, and we took a picture outside of one of the most famous ones. These are called Bab, or door. And of course you have the sentry who makes sure you don't have a password, you can't get in after it's dark, and back in the day. But Marrakesh is also known as the Red City, and it's very famous for being home to the Arab world's largest square, the Jemaa el Fna, which Americans love to go there, people from Europe love to go there, because that's where you see all the snake charmers, the dancers, the fire eaters, the henna artists, but it's really a carnival of the, most outlandish stereotypes that you have of the Middle East. And so once you leave the Jemaa el Fna, then you can see the real Morocco. But the Jemaa el Fna is just a great place to see for the theater. Yeah.
Is there a railroad line that runs into Marrakesh?
Yes. Yes. I don't know. Did you go by rail?
I didn't. No. But I saw. We planned a trip, but we didn't. It goes on the west coast, right?
Yeah. Morocco has some limited railways that go along the coast, especially up to the north. I believe it goes to Marrakesh as well, but I'm not 100% sure.
Is it called the Marrakesh Express?
Yes.
Yes, you can take the train from Marrakesh to Tangier.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was built by the French.
Right. It's more of a north-south.
How long is that
access?
From Tangier to Marrakesh by train?
We had planned to take a lot of American tourists take the overnight train from Marrakesh and catch it at night, and you wake up at 8 in the morning, you have left at 8 at night. By 8 in the morning, you're in Tangier.
I have a lot of my students who went on the trip here. Maybe they can share what they like the best about the trip or about Morocco with us.
What was your favorite food that you had? What kind of tajin? The beef tajin.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
I like the chicken.
You took the trip to west of Marrakesh to the, how do you pronounce it?
Essaouira.
The
Ouarzazate?
Yeah.
You mean in the sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you all go there? The best meal I ate in Morocco was there.
In
a French restaurant, the one that cooked.
You said you've been to, she's been to Agadir.
Agadir, Casablanca.
She liked Agadir the best, that's what I remember.
No, she liked Casablanca.
Oh, you did? Okay.
Americans always ask about the famous Casablanca movie, whether there really was a bar, and that's not a true story.
We went to the to Rick's Cafe, which is from the famous Casablanca movie with Humphrey Bogart, and I typically take students there, and I didn't have a very good experience last time. They tell me we should go, you should go back, but I'm kind of a snooty customer, and they didn't. They took too long to bring my food, and it's nice to go there to see it. And so, but many of the students haven't seen Casablanca. I think we have seen it, but younger students typically have not seen it. Have you seen it, Maggie? You've seen it? Anyone else seen Casablanca, the movie?
Yeah.
Here? Yeah. It's good to go. I mean, it's a Casablanca. It's not hard to find, and go for a drink and or a lunch or dinner.
Did you
we'll go again?
Did your group visit Chef Show?
Yes.
Yes. What was your experience at the Blue City of as the hot travel? Take a few things.
I got lost.
They use a lot of blue in any of the buildings and the streets, the little alleys. And they also are known for growing kief or hashish. The Moroccan government seems to turn a blind eye to that because they get to export that, and a lot of Europeans are visiting there because it's a laid-back place.
I thought it was just
But I don't know about I know that it's been, because it's up in the mountains, it's definitely a place where people who would probably flee persecution would go to. And also people who wanted to just get away from laws.
Definitely one of the in places in the world anybody really wants to visit. Any further questions? I'm sure Casper having entertained questions.
Yeah, and if you guys want to come and look at some of that stuff up here.
Before we...
you can actually use this argan oil, I don't mind. Just spray it on your hand and in your hair. And
what is argon?
Can someone tell us what our argon is?
It's a plant that grows on my
cosmetic argan oil, and this is pure argan oil, so like the stuff that you're buying in the, you know, for your hair or your skin in the stores these days will have a little bit, it'll say Moroccan argan, but if you look at it, it's not pure argan, and so this is like gold.
What's
that?
We visited the factory.
Yeah, this is where we got
there
that.
There are different grades, actually.
Yes, yeah, and I don't know, I mean, they told us it's a good grade, and it says it's 100%, and
yes. It was amazing.
The goats will go up and do the argon tree.
Yeah,
and so it's really neat to see a goat up in the tree. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I didn't know
if they set that up or.
No, I think
they're
I don't think so.
Yeah, I agree.
One of the other big things, of course, to visit Marrakesh are the gardens, right? And of course, they're
the Mayoral Gardens, the
French designer.
Yes, Givenchy.
Keeping up with the